Chapter 42. Within so many yards of this Covent Garden lodging of mine, as within so many yards of Westminster Abbey, St. Paul's Cathedral, the Houses of Parliament, the prisons, the courts of justice, all the institutions that govern the land, I can find must find, whether I will or no, in the open streets, shameful instances of neglect of children, intolerable toleration of the engenderment of paupers, idlers, thieves, races of wretched and destructive cripples both in body and mind, a misery to themselves, a misery to the community, a disgrace to civilization, and an outrage on Christianity. I know it to be a fact as easy of demonstration as any sum in any of the elementary rules of arithmetic, that if the state would begin its work and duty at the beginning, and would with a strong hand take those children out of the streets, while they are yet children, and wisely train them, it would make them a part of England's glory, not its shame. Of England's strength, not its weakness, would raise good soldiers and sailors, and good citizens, and many great men, out of the seats of its criminal population. Yet I go on bearing with the enormity, as if it were nothing, and I go on reading the parliamentary debates, as if they were something, and I concern myself far more about one railway bridge across a public thoroughfare, than about a dozen generations of scrofula, ignorance, wickedness, prostitution, poverty, and felony. I can slip out at my door, in the small hours after any midnight, and, in one circuit of the purlieus of Covent Garden Market, can behold a state of infancy and youth, as vile as if a Bourbon sat upon the English throne, a great police force looking on with authority, to do no more than worry, and hunt the dreadful vermin in two corners, and there leave them. Within the length of a few streets I can find a workhouse, mismanaged with that dull short-sighted obstinacy, that its greatest opportunities, as to the children it receives, are lost, and yet not a farthing saved to anyone. But the wheel goes round, and round, and round, and because it goes round, so I am told by the politest authorities it goes well. Apostrophe, thus I reflected, one day in the Whitsun week last past, as I floated down the Thames among the bridges, looking not inappropriately at the drags that were hanging up at certain dirty stairs, to hook the drowned out, and at the numerous conveniences provided to facilitate their tumbling in. My object in that uncommercial journey called up another train of thought, and it ran as follows. When I was at school, one of 70 boys, I wonder by what secret understanding our attention began to wander when we had pored over our books for some hours. I wonder by what ingenuity we brought on that confused state of mind when sense became nonsense, when figures wouldn't work, when dead languages wouldn't construe, when live languages wouldn't be spoken, when memory wouldn't come, when dullness and vacancy wouldn't go. I cannot remember that we ever conspired to be sleepy after dinner, or that we ever particularly wanted to be stupid, and to have flushed faces and hot beating heads, or to find blank hopelessness and obscurity this afternoon in what would become perfectly clear and bright in the freshness of tomorrow morning. We suffered for these things, and they made us miserable enough. Neither do I remember that we ever bound ourselves by any secret oath or other solemn obligation to find the seats getting too hard to be sat upon after a certain time, or to have intolerable twitches in our legs, rendering us aggressive and malicious with those members, or to be troubled with a similar uneasiness in our elbows, attended with fistic consequences to our neighbors, or to carry 2 pounds of lead in the chest, 4 pounds in the head, and several active blue bottles in each ear. Yet, for certain, we suffered under those distresses, and were always charged at for laboring under them, as if we had brought them on, of our own deliberate act and deed. As to the mental portion of them being my own fault in my own case, I should like to ask any well-trained and experienced teacher, not to say psychologist. And as to the physical portion, I should like to ask Professor Owen. Apostrophe, it happened that I had a small bundle of papers with me on what is called the half-time system in schools. referring to one of those papers I found, that the indefatigable Mr. Chadwick had been beforehand with me, and had already asked Professor Owen, who had handsomely replied that I was not to blame, but that, being troubled with a skeleton, and having been constituted according to certain natural laws, I and my skeleton were unfortunately bound by those laws even in school, and had comported ourselves accordingly. Much comforted by the good professors being on my side, I read on to discover whether the indefatigable Mr. Chadwick had taken up the mental part of my afflictions. I found that he had, and that he had gained on my behalf, Sir Benjamin Brodie, Sir David Wilkie, Sir Walter Scott, and the common sense of mankind. For which I beg Mr. Chadwick, if this should meet his eye, to accept my warm acknowledgments. Up to that time I had retained a misgiving that the 70 unfortunates of whom I was one must have been, without knowing it, leagued together by the spirit of evil in a sort of perpetual Guy Fawkes plot, to grope about in vaults with dark lanterns after a certain period of continuous study. But now the misgiving vanished, and I floated on with a quieted mind, to see the half-time system in action. For that was the purpose of my journey, both by steamboat on the Thames, and by very dirty railway on the shore. To which last institution, I beg to recommend the legal use of coke as engine fuel, rather than the illegal use of coal. The recommendation is quite disinterested, for I was most liberally supplied with small coal on the journey, for which no charge was made. I had not only my eyes, nose, and ears filled, but my hat, and all my pockets, and my pocketbook, and my watch. The 5 D.S.C.R.C. or very dirty and small coal railway company delivered me close to my destination, and I soon found the half-time system established in spacious premises, and freely placed at my convenience and disposal. What would I see first of the half-time system? I chose military drill. Attention! Apostrophe instantly 100 boys stood forth in the paved yard as one boy, bright, quick, eager, steady, watchful for the look of command, instant and ready for the word. Not only was there complete precision, complete accord to the eye and to the ear, but an alertness in the doing of the thing which deprived it, curiously, of its monotonous or mechanical character. There was perfect uniformity, and yet an individual spirit and emulation. No spectator could doubt that the boys liked it. With non-commissioned officers varying from a yard to a yard and a half high, the result could not possibly have been attained otherwise. They marched, and counter-marched, and formed in line and square, and company, and single file and double file, and performed a variety of evolutions, almost admirably. In respect of an air of enjoyable understanding of what they were about, which seems to be forbidden to English soldiers, the boys might have been small French troops. When they were dismissed, and the broadsword exercise, limited to a much smaller number, succeeded, the boys who had no part in that new drill, either looked on attentively, or disported themselves in a gymnasium hard by. The steadiness of the broadsword boys on their short legs, and the firmness with which they sustained the different positions, was truly remarkable. The broadsword exercise over, suddenly there was great excitement and a rush. Naval drill. In the corner of the ground, stood a deck mimic ship, with real masts, yards, and sails mainmast 70 feet high. At the word of command from the skipper of this ship, a mahogany-faced old salt, with the indispensable quid in his cheek, the true nautical roll, and all wonderfully complete, the rigging was covered with a swarm of boys. One, the first to spring into the shrouds, outstripping all the others, and resting on the truck of the main topmast in no time. And now we stood out to sea, in a most amazing manner. The skipper himself, the whole crew, the uncommercial, and all hands present, implicitly believing that there was not a moment to lose, that the wind at that instant chopped round and sprung up fair, and that we were away on a voyage round the world. Get all sail upon her. With a will, my lads. Lay out upon the main yard there. Look alive at the weather earing. Cheery, my boys. Let go the sheet now. Stand by at the braces, you. With a will, aloft there. Belly, starboard watch. Pfeiffer. Come aft, Pfeiffer, and give 'em a tune. Forthwith, springs up Pfeiffer, fife in hand, smallest boy ever seen, big lump on temple, having lately fallen down on a paving stone, gives 'em a tune with all his might and main. Hooroar, Pfeiffer. With a will, my lads. Tip 'em a livelier one, Pfeiffer. Pfeiffer tips 'em a livelier one, and excitement increases. Shake 'em out, my lads. Well done. There you have her. Pretty, pretty. Every rag upon her she can carry, wind right astarn, and ship cutting through the water 15 knots an hour. At this favorable moment of her voyage, I gave the alarm a man overboard. Apostrophe, apostrophe, on the gravel, but he was immediately recovered, none the worse. Presently, I observed the skipper overboard, but forbore to mention it, as he seemed in no wise disconcerted by the accident. Indeed, I soon came to regard the skipper as an amphibious creature, for he was so perpetually plunging overboard, to look up at the hands aloft, that he was oftener in the bosom of the ocean than on deck. His pride in his crew on those occasions was delightful, and the conventional unintelligibility of his orders in the ears of uncommercial landlubbers and loblolly boys, though they were always intelligible to the crew, was hardly less pleasant. But we couldn't expect to go on in this way forever. Dirty weather came on, and then worse weather, and when we least expected it, we got into tremendous difficulties. Screw loose in the chart, perhaps something certainly wrong somewhere, but here we were with breakers ahead, my lads, driving head on, slap on a lee shore. The skipper broached this terrific announcement in such great agitation, that the small fifer, not fifing now, but standing looking on near the wheel with his fife under his arm, seemed for the moment quite unbuoyed, though he speedily recovered his presence of mind. In the trying circumstances that ensued, the skipper and the crew proved worthy of one another. The skipper got dreadfully hoarse, but otherwise was master of the situation. The man at the wheel did wonders. All hands, except the fifer, were turned up to wear ship, and I observed the fifer, when we were at our greatest extremity, to refer to some document in his waistcoat pocket, which I conceived to be his will. I think she struck. I was not myself conscious of any collision, but I saw the skipper so very often washed overboard and back again, that I could only impute it to the beating of the ship. I am not enough of a seaman to describe the maneuvers by which we were saved, but they made the skipper very hot, French polishing his mahogany face, and the crew very nimble, and succeeded to a marvel. For, within a few minutes of the first alarm, we had wore ship, and got her off, and were all a tauto, which I felt very grateful for. Not that I knew what it was, but that I perceived, that we had not been all a tauto lately. Land now appeared on our weather bow, and we shaped our course for it, having the wind abeam, and frequently changing the man at the helm, in order that every man might have his spell. We worked into harbor under prosperous circumstances, and furled our sails, and squared our yards, and made all ship shape and handsome, and so our voyage ended. When I complimented the skipper at parting on his exertions, and those of his gallant crew, he informed me that the latter were provided for the worst, all hands being taught to swim and dive. And he added, that the able seaman at the main topmast truck especially, could dive as deep as he could go high. The next adventure, that befell me in my visit to the short-timers, was the sudden apparition of a military band. I had been inspecting the hammocks of the crew of the good ship, when I saw with astonishment, that several musical instruments, brazen and of great size, appeared to have suddenly developed two legs each, and to be trotting about a yard. And my astonishment was heightened, when I observed a large drum, that had previously been leaning helpless against a wall, taking up a stout position on four legs. Approaching this drum and looking over it, I found two boys behind it. It was too much for one, and then I found that each of the brazen instruments had brought out a boy, and was going to discourse sweet sounds. The boys, not omitting the fifer, now playing a new instrument, were dressed in neat uniform, and stood up in a circle at their music stands, like any other military band. They played a march or two, and then we had cheer boys. Cheer, and then we had Yankee Doodle, and we finished, as in loyal duty bound, with God Save the Queen. The band's proficiency was perfectly wonderful, and it was not at all wonderful that the whole body corporate of short-timers listened with faces of the liveliest interest and pleasure. What happened next among the short-timers? As if the band had blown me into a great classroom out of their brazen tubes, in a great classroom I found myself now, with the whole choral force of short-timers singing the praises of a summer's day to the harmonium, and my small but highly respected friend the fifer blazing away vocally, as if he had been saving up his wind for the last 12 months. Also the whole crew of the good ship Nameless swarming up and down the scale, as if they had never swarmed up and down the rigging. This done, we threw our whole power into God Bless the Prince of Wales, and blessed His Royal Highness to such an extent that, for my own uncommercial part, I gasped again when it was over. The moment this was done, we formed, with surpassing freshness, in two hollow squares, and fell to work at oral lessons, as if we never did, and had never thought of doing, anything else. Let a veil be drawn over the self-committals into which the uncommercial traveler would have been betrayed, but for a discreet reticence, coupled with an air of absolute wisdom on the part of that artful personage. Take the square of 5, multiply it by 15, divide it by 3, deduct 8 from it, add 4 dozen to it, give me the result in pence, and tell me how many eggs I could get for it at 3 farthings apiece. The problem is hardly stated, when a dozen small boys pour out answers. Some wide, some very nearly right, some worked as far as they go with such accuracy, as at once to show what link of the chain has been dropped in the hurry. For the moment, none are quite right, but behold a laboring spirit beating the buttons on its corporeal waistcoat, in a process of internal calculation, and knitting an accidental bump on its corporeal forehead in a concentration of mental arithmetic. It is my honorable friend, if he will allow me to call him so, the fifer. With right arm eagerly extended in token of being inspired with an answer, and with right leg foremost, the fifer solves the mystery. Then recalls both arm and leg, and with bump in ambush awaits the next poser. Take the square of 3, multiply it by 7, divide it by 4, add 50 to it, take 13 from it, multiply it by 2, double it, give me the result in pence, and say how many halfpence. Wise as the serpent is the 4 feet of performer on the nearest approach to that instrument, whose right arm instantly appears, and quenches this arithmetical fire. Tell me something about Great Britain, tell me something about its principal productions, tell me something about its ports, tell me something about its seas and rivers, tell me something about coal, iron, cotton, timber, tin, and turpentine. The hollow square bristles with extended right arms, but ever faithful to fact as the fifer, ever wise as the serpent as the performer on that instrument, ever prominently buoyant and brilliant are all members of the band. I observe the player of the cymbals, to dash at a sounding answer now, and then rather than not cut in at all, but I take that to be in the way of his instrument. All these questions, and many such, are put on the spur of the moment, and by one who has never examined these boys. The uncommercial, invited to add another, falteringly demands how many birthdays a man born on the 29th of February will have had on completing his 50th year. A general perception of trap and pitfall instantly arises, and the fifer is seen to retire behind the corduroys of his next neighbors, as perceiving special necessity for collecting himself and communing with his mind. Meanwhile, the wisdom of the serpent suggests that the man will have had only one birthday in all that time, for how can any man have more than one, seeing that he is born once and dies once? The blushing on commercial stands corrected, and amends the formula. Pondering ensues, two or three wrong answers are offered, and symbol strikes up six. Apostrophe apostrophe but doesn't know why. Then modestly emerging from his academic grove of corduroys appears the fifer, right arm extended, right leg foremost, bump irradiated. 12, and 2 over. Apostrophe apostrophe, the feminine short-timers passed a similar examination, and very creditably too. Would have done better perhaps, with a little more. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.